show of hands in here today, all right? You came in here today. Who of you are a friend? Are you a friend to someone? Is anyone in here a friend to someone? Are you a friend? Right? Does anyone in here have friends? You have friends? Okay. You would like to think so. But like many other words in our English language, such as love, right? We hear love. I love my dog. I love golf. I love the Bengals. I love my wife, right? The word love, we kind of take and we have watered it down to kind of mean just kind of whatever. I can love a steak sandwich and I can love my kid, right? The word friend has been hijacked and watered down. When you learn today what it really means to be a friend and to have friends, you may walk out of here realizing that maybe you don't have as many friends as you think that you did. With Facebook and Instagram, all you say, I have 10,000 friends, right? We might think a little differently on friendship after today. Or maybe you haven't been a friend to the people that you say that you care about. Or your third option, right? You may walk out of here in this camp, that it's all too much work, and that your dogs at home are totally good enough to be your friends. You don't need friends, right? So today I'm gonna show you a model of friendship. I'm gonna challenge you today, and I want to show you a model that's worth duplicating. It's a friendship and a love that's so radical that they're willing to give whatever it takes, even including their own lives. And when I say the word radical, this is what the word radical means. Radical means relating to or affecting the fundamental nature of something. So when you have a true friend, their thoughts, their feelings, their worldview, right? They're mutually and fundamentally, they're changing you, whether you know it or not. And so the people that you choose to allow in your life, the people that you allow to speak truth, they're literally molding and making you into the human that you are. And so it's important to surround yourself with truth-speaking, life-speaking, joy-speaking people. Because they're making you, they're molding you. And so I'm going to lay out a blueprint. I'm going to give us the golden standard of friendship. And if you follow this blueprint, then your friendship has its greatest chance of success. And so while I'm here, I want to go through the other biblical truths that might be taught from this pulpit of any model or religion, worldview that I've investigated, right? I've looked around and I've seen what's out there. Listen, folks, I want to tell you that the winning life formula is found in God's word. The principles that are taught, right, that Jesus taught, we can, if you would like to throw out the fact that he was the savior of the world, you can throw that part out. But the teachings and the principles that Jesus have taught are inarguably the most practical and efficient for human beings. I would be willing to argue that with anyone's worldview. Again, we can throw out the savior part, you know, we can argue that. But to live by his teachings is the best way. Two people that followed these principles were David and Jonathan. But before we get into their actual friendship, I want to give you a little bit of background. I don't want to assume that you know who David and Jonathan is. And so when I'm talking about David in the Bible, he's most notably known for killing a giant, right? David and Goliath. That's the David that we're talking about. He enjoyed watching a lady take a bath named Bathsheba. You probably know him for that story as well. But David was known for a man after God's own heart. That's the David that we're talking about today. And so we're going to pick up the story just a short time after David kills Goliath. All right, so David would have been in his teenage years somewhere, and he kills Goliath. And obviously, the killing of this Philistine champion would have been very big news. So naturally, the Israelite king at the time, it was the first Israelite king. His name was Saul, all right? He started to get to know David, right? David was the son of a guy named Jesse. So David had been playing the harp. David was a harp player, and he was serving in Saul's court because what happened to Saul, okay, he started living a little crazy. He got out of the will of God. And so Saul would get sad. Saul would get depressed. In 1 Samuel 16:14, it says this: the Lord sent a tormenting spirit that filled him with depression and fear. All right? So Saul had this overwhelming depression, and David would come and he would play his harp, and Saul would feel better, right? It would relax him. He would feel better. And so the relationship would have been strictly business. Obviously, Saul, being the king, would not have been concerned with who the harp player was, right? As long as I feel better. But after Goliath, after this harp player kills the Philistine champion, things change. And so by being around the king, David gets to meet the people that are there. And so he has the opportunity to meet Saul's son. And Saul's son is named Jonathan. And so this is where we begin to see the beginning of a very beautiful and radical friendship. And so today, this is what we're going to talk about. Okay, I'm going to challenge you with four foundational truths that I believe are required to have this radical type of friendship. Okay, these four truths are challenging. This is going to be tough. We're talking about tough stuff, just like everything else that we talk. Like, this is hard. This is going to be a challenge for you in your life. But number one, the first truth is this that I want to get out there. It's this: great friendships require great commitment. I'm going to pick up in 1 Samuel 18:1. 1 Samuel 18:1, if you're following along, it says this: after David had finished talking with Saul, he met Jonathan, the king's son. There was an immediate bond between them, for Jonathan loved David. Do you have that person that you have met in your life at some point, and there was just something about that person that you just clicked? They were your person, your interest. You said something. Did we just become best friends? You just click, right? You just meet that person and you click. This happened with David and Jonathan. Listen, King James actually doest a fantasticist, jobbeth, at capturing this image, okay? It says this in the King James, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. That word knit used there, okay? Listen, I'm not a knitter. I don't even know if that's really the right terminology. A knitter, one who knits. Knitter, right? Is that right? Okay. But I know what knitting is, okay? I know what that word means, and I know it's not quite the same, but my grandma, she was a big crocheter. Y'all know what crochet is, right? So I would just sit there, and as a little kid, I can remember just seeing this ball of yarn, and then she would start doing this stuff, and I would just watch it, and it would just transform into whatever she was making, whether it was a blanket. But to watch those and just watch the integral, like for me at this point, I would go absolutely insane to do such a menial, like the thought of it is giving me anxiety, but like it's cool to watch that process. And how it would start with a ball of yarn, and it would end with something awesome. But you knit by interlocking loops of wool or yarn or whatever you're using with knitting needles, right? So you're most literally taking two and you're making them, they're becoming one, inseparable. When I look at a blanket, I don't see just the individual pieces of yarn. I see a blanket. I see this that turned from this, and now we've taken and we've made it one piece, right? We don't know where one ends and one begins. This is what commitment looks like. Commitment. I need you to understand what this word means, okay? Commitment means this. Commitment is an agreement or a pledge to do something in the future. Notice there isn't... Please notice there isn't anything in here in the definition of commitment. There's nothing in the definition that has anything to do with how you're feeling. Your feelings have nothing to do with your commitment. But we're in the midst of a generation, folks, that they're committed until something else better comes along. Whether that's friendship, whether that's your job, whether that's your marriage. Matt, I fell out of love. What are you talking about? You fell out of love. You're committed. I don't care how you feel today. You want to push them in front of a bus? Join the club. But you committed to that person. You fell out of love. Get the heck out of here with that crap. What do you mean? You made a commitment. You're committed to your church until someone says something you don't like. Every day, every single day, I must wake up and commit, recommit, and recommit again to my wife. Every day. I've got to recommit to loving her. And if that commitment isn't there, things go south very, very quickly. Real commitment, it comes with the mentality that no matter what happens, no matter what, no matter what comes through that door, if you've done any kind of premarriage counseling with me, I hammer this because it's got to start here. If you're not committed, you're not going anywhere. Whatever comes through that door, we're all in. It's not based on my feelings. It's not based on my emotions, how I feel this day or that day. I'm committed. Look at what seals Jonathan's commitment to David. 1 Samuel 18 says this, verse 2 through 4, from that day on, Saul kept David with him and wouldn't let him return home. And Jonathan made a solemn pact, a commitment with David, because he loved him as he loved himself. Jonathan sealed the pact by taking off his robe and giving it to David, together with his tunic, sword, bow, and belt. So here we see the sealing of these vows that were made. After the verbal agreement came the physical display of sealing the vow. And so remember, please, I didn't talk too much about Jesse, but Jesse was very humble, right? His father, David's father, they came from very humble beginnings, right? His father, Jesse, was a sheep herder, right? He was a sheep herder. So in Bethlehem, just nice guy, but no one really would have known who Jesse was. And so these items that were being given by Jonathan, they would have been incredibly nice, the best that, you know, time could have, best available at that time. But he wanted him to have the best. He wanted his friend to have the best because he loved him like he loved himself. And if my friend has the best, then I have the best. When I put a ring on my wife's finger, it was by far the most valuable thing I had to offer. Thankfully, I had a grandma that gave me my diamond ring. Thank you, grandma. And she gave me the diamond, and I got to design the ring, and it was really cool. But that was by far the most valuable thing. Annie said she would have been fine with the ring pop, but I wanted to give her the best, right? I think she's also full of crap, but there's no way she would have taken a ring pop. Right, Deb? Right? Okay. She still loves me, and I want her to have the best, right? When I made that vow, I made a commitment to my wife that for the rest of my natural life, forever, that I will enjoy falling more and more in love with her every single day. That's the commitment that I made. And in a couple days, that commitment will have been fulfilled for 15 years. You believe that? September 23rd. It is her birthday and our 15-year anniversary. And I think you said no, Deb. Great friendship. Second truth here is this. Because if you have a strong friendship, it's going to take commitment. The commitment's going to get tested, right? It's not if, it's when. And will you bail or will you not bail? Your commitment says you're not allowed. You committed. You cannot bail. There is no option. But it's going to get tested. Not if, but when. And this leads me to my second truth. Second truth is this. Great friendships involve great sacrifice. Listen, if you've called yourself a friend to anyone, you've discovered that there's times that your friendship asks you for something. If you're a friend to someone, at some point, if you are a real friend, that friendship will ask something of you. It asks you to make a sacrifice. And in a good friendship, there's going to be times where getting out of that comfort zone is going to be absolutely necessary for your friendship to thrive. Because anything, listen to me, church, anything worth anything is going to take work. Anything. Part of that is sacrifice. See, this is where the rubber meets the road. It turns from lip service, this is my friend, to doing something, right? This sacrifice, this is where the friendship asks something of me. People don't like this part because now it's causing some discomfort in your life. right? The focus switches from me to now someone else. In your relationships, your marriage, right? If you're not willing to sacrifice for that other person, you are in some serious trouble. You can quickly find your real friends when friendship demands something, right? You'll find your real friends real quick when you need something. So as this story of friendship continues, God continues to bless David in every way, every single way. In verse 5, it says this. It says that whatever Saul asked David to do, David did it successfully. Any battle, any strategic plan, call David, it's going to get done. This made Saul incredibly jealous, naturally, as the king. Jealousy to the point that when David was playing his harp for Saul, right? Saul takes a spear, picks it up, tries to pin David to the wall. Listen, Saul did this several times. Threw a spear at David's head while he was playing. So we have a depressed king, okay? A mentally unstable king. We have an anointed David, the next king of Israel, and we have Jonathan. Jonathan is right smack dab in the middle. And for all intents and purposes, Jonathan is the next king, right? He is the future king of Israel. God had David in line, but they didn't know that. So you see Jonathan's predicament, but remember the first truth, right? We see where Jonathan is. I'm in a bad spot. But he goes back to point number one, truth number one. I made a commitment. It's not being there. Listen to me very carefully. You don't hear anything else today. Commitment is not being there when everything is going right. Commitment is being there still when everything is going wrong. The predicament is clear. Between your father, your family, the passing of his kingdom, and then here's your best friend, David. Things continue heating up because David continues winning. He's winning. Everything he does, he's winning. And there's a moment there in chapter 18, verse 28. Saul realizes that the Lord was with David, and he realized how much his daughter Michal loved him. Saul became more afraid of David. 1 Samuel 19:1 says this, Saul now urged his servants and his son, Jonathan, to assassinate David. But Jonathan, because of his strong affection for David, told him what his father was planning. So he goes and he tells David, right? David says, daggone it, go talk to your dad, please, what have I done? So here's the paraphrase of Jonathan and Saul. Listen, Saul says, son, listen, I really want to kill your friend. He's very successful. He's a huge threat. Jonathan says, Dad, listen, he killed a giant. Everywhere he goes, he stomps a mud hole in the Philistines. Like, he really hasn't done anything wrong to us. You weren't complaining when he was doing the good things. Like, just leave him alone, okay? So, listen, he says this. Okay, son, I won't kill him. I won't kill David, right? So you have to understand the risk. Again, risk that Jonathan took coming to his father to plead for David's life, right? That he took his own life into his hand because Saul is mentally unstable. He's throwing spears at people, right? He's unstable. And for his son to come and say, listen, I really like David, don't kill him. That was a risk. That was a sacrifice because no one is safe. Not long after this very conversation, when Saul says, I'm not going to kill him, he throws another spear at David's head. But Jonathan was committed. He knew that with that commitment comes great sacrifice, but he also understood this. He understood that their friendship, right? Their relationship, your friendship, your marriage, it goes beyond just the two individuals. It's bigger than that, right? There's something deeper that's holding these two together. They had a common denominator when things got bad. There's a true north. When their entire world is going berserk, people are trying to kill them. It just would have been turmoil. They had a common denominator. They had something in common, and that was God. Leads me to my third truth is this. Great friendships include God. When you think of your current friendship, what is the glue that is holding your friendship together? What is it that is making you a cohesive unit? Why are you spending time together? Is it your common interests? Is it a sports team? Is it family friends? Did you adopt some friends and inherited some friends? Listen, for friendships to be great, they need to go deeper than that. See, this truth hits particularly hard with me when it comes to my best friend, right? This hits very close to my front doorstep because with my mate for life, my best friend, there were times that I was not committed. There was times where I tried to exclude God, where I didn't want to sacrifice anything for anyone. And I gave Annie every opportunity, every reason in the world to hit the eject button. But if you ask her to this day, almost 15 years later, right, she'll tell you that there was times where she did not recognize the man that she married. She did not recognize anything that could ever be lovable at all. But because she loved God, when we got married, we stood in front of my father, in front of God, and I don't know how many hundreds of people, and we made a commitment. And in those times where that commitment could have been very easily broken and should have been, in the back of her mind, she says, you know what? I made a commitment that says, you know, it's bigger than me. This goes way beyond just Matt and I. We have children, and we have, you know, you have a legacy that you have to think about. And so if you're not including God, you're going to be in trouble. So because she loved God, she knew that our relationship went beyond us. And I tell this to our teenagers. I tell this to our young adults. I tell this to my own children, at least on a weekly basis. I say this. Listen, find someone, when you're talking about marriage or friendship in this case, find someone that loves Jesus more than you. If you can find someone that loves Jesus more than you, Matthew 6:33 says this, seek the kingdom of God above all else, not some else, all else, and live righteously, and he will give you what? Everything you need. So if I am looking for a friend that loves Jesus more than they love me, listen, a lot of our stuff is going to take care of itself. Scripture can't get any clearer. Put God first. The details are going to fall in line. How? How? Because if you are living these principles out, these principles that we're teaching from this pulpit, that means that you're loving others more than you love yourself. You're committed. That means that you fulfill a commitment even when you don't want to. Jonathan and David understood this truth. Under constant threat of harassment, death, they believed that if they remained faithful and did what they were supposed to do, remaining faithful, remaining committed, keeping God first, God would take care of any situation that came their way. I serve the Father of commitment. I serve the Father who is willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. Why? Because he loves me. I keep God first in the center of my relationship. I try because that's the most effective thing. And I love God because God loved me first. And at the foundation of all of this is love. Great friendship, this is my last point. Great friendship reflects great love. 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 8 says this, if I could speak all the languages of earth and all of angels, but didn't love others, I would only be a noisy gong or clanging cymbal. If I had the gift of prophecy, and if I understood all of God's secret plans and possessed all knowledge, and if I had such faith that I could move mountains but didn't love others, I would be nothing. If I gave everything I have to the poor and even sacrificed my body, I could boast about it. But if I didn't love others, I would have gained nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. It does not demand its own way. It is not irritable. It keeps no record of being wronged. It does not rejoice about injustice, but rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Love never gives up, never loses faith, is always hopeful, and endures through every circumstance. Prophecy and speaking in unknown languages and special knowledge will become useless, but love will last forever. Listen, I read those verses at every wedding that I do. Every wedding. To show the people that are standing in front of me, the people that are out in the crowd, trying to explain to them what love is. But do you know where else these verses are incredibly applicable? Do you know? In every single other area of your life. These verses are what great love looks like. It's not boastful, proud, rude. It rejoices when truth wins out. Never loses faith. Always hopeful. Every circumstance. Patient. Kind. Not irritable. Keeps no records of being wronged. In a fight, you don't go historical on someone over what you did 10 years ago. Because love doesn't keep track of that. Why did Jonathan and David make a commitment to each other? Because they loved one another. Why were they willing to make sacrifices? Because they loved one another. Why did they keep God at the center of the relationship? Because God loved them first. John 13, 35. Your love for one another will prove to the world that you are my disciples. How you love your friends, how you love your spouse is a direct testimony of your Christian walk, your relationship. I should be able to look at your friendship. I should be able to look at your marriage and see Jesus. That's the goal, right? It all starts with love. As the story unfolds, we see Saul's attempt on David's life continue to escalate, both in frequency and fervor. Listen, Saul was really trying to kill David. He tried using David's wife. He tried using the army. And he even cusses Jonathan out when he refuses to kill his best friend again. In chapter 20, David and Jonathan make one last ditch effort. One last time to see if it's possible to live in harmony with Saul. 1 Samuel, this is the story here. You ready? 1 Samuel 20, 11 through 17. Come out to the field with me, Jonathan replied. And they went out there together. Then Jonathan told David, I promise by the Lord, the God of Israel, that by this time tomorrow or the next day at the latest, I will talk to my father and let him know at once how he feels about you. If he speaks favorably about you, I will let you know. But if he is angry and wants you killed, may the Lord strike me and even kill me if I don't warn you so that you can escape and live. May the Lord be with you as long as he used to be with my father. Little dig at Saul, right? He used to be with Saul. And may you treat me with the faithful love of the Lord as long as I live. But if I die, treat my family with faithful love. Can I tell you, if you fast forward, right? He does. David actually allows Jonathan's son to live with him in the palace. So again, commitment, right? He held true to this. Even when the Lord destroys all our enemies from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a solemn pact with David saying, may the Lord destroy all your enemies. And Jonathan made David reaffirm his vow of friendship again. For Jonathan loved David as he loved himself. Listen, there's that recommitment again. They're recommitting. They're reminding. We need reminded sometimes, right? The plan was for Jonathan to find out from his dad if David had any chance of reconciliation. That was the plan, all right? I'm going to go talk to my dad. I'll let you know. Don't do anything crazy. I'm going to let you know. No, in the next day or two, all right? So, plan's going, he goes and talks to his dad. All right, David goes and hides in a field. Jonathan comes out to the field acting like he's going to do some target practice with some arrows, right? So he tells David, I'm going to shoot three arrows. And so Jonathan's going to send a boy out to retrieve the arrows. If Jonathan tells the boy when he goes to get the arrows, they're on this side, right? There's a rock pile. And he was shooting these arrows out there. If he says to the boy, the arrows are on this side, okay, then that's me telling you, David, that you're safe. If I say the arrows are on this side, David, you're safe. If I tell the boy, go further, the arrows are still ahead of you, then David, I'm telling you, you must leave immediately. So if I say this, it means that. If I say keep going, that means you better get out of here. Your life is in danger. What do you think happens? Verse 35. The next morning, as agreed, Jonathan went out into the field, took a young boy with him to gather his arrows. Verse 36. Start running, he told the boy, so you can find the arrows as I shoot them. Sounds a little sketchy. Anyway, so the boy ran, and Jonathan shot an arrow beyond him. When the boy had almost reached the arrow, Jonathan shouted, the arrow is still ahead of you. Hurry, hurry, don't wait. So the boy quickly gathered up the arrows and ran back to his master. He, of course, suspected nothing. Only Jonathan and David understood the signal. Then Jonathan gave his bow and arrows to the boy and told him to take them back to the town. As soon as the boy was gone, David came out from where he had been hiding near the stone pile. Then David bowed three times to Jonathan with his face to the ground. I need y'all to get this picture in your mind, right? This is two best friends that are willing to do anything for one another. And Jonathan gets the news from his father that this friendship is not going to work out. That David, if you stay here in this kingdom, my father is going to kill you. Now David gets the news. Now it's starting to sink in. I've served this king. This is my best friend. And so I need you to, as you understand, he comes out from his hiding place and he just bows before his friend. He just bows three times with his face to the ground. Both of them were in tears as they embraced each other and said goodbye, especially David. Here you have two men, two warriors, right? We think of these Bible characters as these soft little, what we see on the flannel graphs when we were growing up. These Bible characters would have been the gnarliest. David would have been a bad man. Saul killed his thousands. David killed his 10,000s. These were warriors. And here they are, and they know that their time is running out, and they're crying. And especially David, he's destroyed by this betrayal of Saul. I've served you faithfully. What have I done wrong? Jonathan, you're my best friend. You die for me. I'm crying. At last, Jonathan said to David, go in peace, for we have sworn loyalty to each other in the Lord's name. I got married in the Lord's name. That's commitment. This friendship, the Lord's name, God first. The Lord is the witness of a bond between us and our children forever. Then David left Jonathan and returned to the town. This, my friends, is the last time that they see each other. David, spoiler alert, I know you're going to go home and read it. But David goes on the run, fleeing for his life. Saul chases. David has several opportunities to kill Saul. He doesn't. Stays faithful. And Jonathan, eventually, at the end of 1 Samuel, dies in battle with his brothers in a battle against the Philistines. And in that same battle, Saul actually falls on his own sword and takes his own life. So the end of the friendship, where we see it end, it's kind of sad, right? It's kind of tragic. But we see in this friendship a commitment and a love that is unrivaled in anything that I really see on a daily basis. I don't see friendships like that. Until the very end. Until the very end, these two were committed. They made countless sacrifices for one another. And most of these scenarios were life and death, right? This is not, you have a sacrifice for your friend, you go pick them up when they're stalled out on the side of the road. Like, no, this is life and death stuff. But because they kept God first, they could experience and reflect a love that we should all strive to emulate. John 15:13 says this, there is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. They were willing to do that in a heartbeat, in a heartbeat. So after hearing what true friendship is, what does your friend list really look like? How good of a friend are you being? You wanna know something crazy? This is wild. It's like a little grand finale, kind of like a two for one. But when we talk about practical life application, I want to give you stuff that you can grab, right? Like, I want to give you the word, but I want to give it to you so then you can take it and you can say, okay, this I can take and I can apply this to my life. Life application, you ready? If you go back through my message today, and every time that I say the word friendship and you replace that word with the word marriage, the principles are still the same. All successful relationships should be adhering to these truths. Because at the end of the day, we will live. Why are we here, right? Why are we here? We're here to give glory to God, honor God. That's why we're on this planet. Are your friendships God-honoring? Is your marriage God-honoring? Some of you say you have a best friend that might be an unbeliever. How have you had that conversation? Do you love them enough? Your BFFs, you love them enough to tell them about Jesus, right? Are you God-honoring? Is your marriage God-honoring? The person that's supposed to be your best friend, biblically, two becoming one. This is hard stuff. Do you know what the Bible calls marriage? It calls it a mystery. It's a mystery. Listen, being a good spouse, it's hard. It's hard stuff. Being a good friend, it's hard. Listen, honestly, after this week and learning and studying friendship and seeing how high the bar is, which is fine, we're setting the bar high. Because guess what? You're probably not going to jump over it, right? Biblical truths are set very, very high. Try to be perfect. Try to be like Jesus. We're not going to get there. But guess what? If your marriage can get here, we're doing work, right? You're doing better. Set the bar high. This is what it takes to make a successful relationship. It's worth it. If you go your entire life and you can say, I've had one or two friends, that's pretty good. Because guess what? Any more than that would be a lot to maintain. To live this way, right? It would be exhausting to have 20 friends that you're wanting to die for and give them your stuff to. But it's what it's expected of us, right? This hard work, this commitment, it's expected of us. So do me a favor this week. Just evaluate your relationships. Evaluate your friendships. Just evaluate and say, am I being the friend to people that the Bible talks about? Am I being a David and a Jonathan? Or are we just kind of acquaintances, which you'll have a lot of those as well. But I want you to love each other. So be committed, right? Commitment starts there. And man, love each other. Be a friend. This world is hurting so bad right now. As the praise team comes, we're going to have our time of response, just a time for you to consider what you heard today, right? When you're thinking about friends and people, relationships, these intersections in life, these are important. You're literally molding and making someone, and they are molding and making you. So it's important to get people in your life that are going to push you to be the best person that you can be.